that's right. We're right here. I have one of our favorite congressmen, Jeff Duncan, on the line with us this morning. Congressman Jeff Duncan, how are you doing today?
Well, Ann, I'm doing great. It's great to be back with you, Sharp Facets Gallery, and on the Ann Show. I just love being on here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, I'm really concerned because some of the news that is coming out from what is happening, I want to talk about some of these issues. Love to get your opinion on them. Number one, yesterday the Senate rejected building the double-tier fencing along the border, saying they didn't want to delay granting illegal immigration legal status. What's happened with the fence? What are we going to do? How are we going to do this? You're on record as saying we've got to build the fence, and you've been down there. What do you think about this?
Well, first off, that was a Senate bill, so we're kind of watching from across what the Senate may or may not do with this immigration bill, but I've been very, very clear that the first thing we've got to do is secure our border. Until we do and stop that hemorrhaging of flow of illegals coming into this country, I think all bets are off on other things, and so I'm a little disappointed that the Senate rejected a more secure border amendment. And I think, you know, we all as Americans have to ask ourselves what a secure border really looks like and define that. Do we want some sort of East Berlin, West Berlin type Berlin Wall situation along the border? If we do, that's okay. I'm not saying that I do. I'm just saying, you know, we just need to define what that border looks like. And I believe we've got to secure it to the point where we know who comes into this country and who doesn't. And I'm concerned that people that are coming to this country aren't all those hardworking Hispanics that are looking to take a job and feed their families down on the southern border. We have what we are, what I guess the intelligence community dubs other than Mexicans. They are catching Africans, Middle Eastern, Asian folks that have crossed our border. They're catching them in Texas and Arizona and New Mexico. I have to ask, what are those folks coming here for? And so a secure border keeps those type people out of our country and protects U.S. sovereignty.
You know, Senator Lindsey Graham says that we must pass the immigration bill if Republicans are ever going to regain the White House. Do you agree that we have to pass an immigration bill for this to happen?
I don't agree with that we've got to pass some sort of comprehensive immigration reform that grants amnesty to so many folks that have broke our laws coming here known as illegal aliens. I do think we ought to address some of the issues, a secure border being part of that, dealing with the 41 to 49% of the illegals that are here that came here legally. They came here with a guest pass or a visa, whether it's a student visa or a guest worker program, visa to work, or whether it was a tourist visa, and decided to stay. We know who these people are. They had an interview at the consulate or the embassy. We know where they were going, their address, where they were going to work, where they were staying. These are people that we know something about. It's not like we're chasing a footprint in the desert. We need to deal with that. And then I'm fine with talking about an expanded guest worker program that allows folks to come in and work in the agriculture sectors, so hospitality sectors that we need where we can't get Americans to take those jobs. I'm sympathetic of the workers, the farmers even, let's say the peach farmers that need the workers to pick their peaches. They're having trouble getting those workers. I'm fine with having a conversation about an expanded guest worker program that doesn't lead to citizenship other than what current law allows. You know, someone that comes here as a guest worker, they want to become a United States citizen, they can go through a normal process just like anybody from anywhere around the world. So I'm fine with, you know, looking at the numbers, how many folks we allow to come in, what we require of them, the type ID cards we give them when they're here, how long they stay. I'm fine with looking at all that, as long as we are very, very clear that this isn't a pathway to citizenship known as amnesty, which is just granted for those that that broke the laws coming here.
Well, you know, one of the things that actually that followed into my next question is that I think back in 1986, the guest worker program allowed 55,000 workers to come in, and of course today the need is huge. But one of the things that amazed me when I was doing some research on this, that the wage difference between what a guest worker can get, $9.79 an hour plus housing plus transportation, and yet the minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. no wonder we're having problems getting our people to take those jobs.
That's right. I mean, it's out of balance. And the reason being is the Department of Labor said, look, we want to encourage these employers to hire American workers, and so we're going to jack the minimum wage requirement up for the guest worker, requiring that that employer to pay a higher wage to the guest worker to try to encourage them to hire somebody at a lower wage, an American worker. Well, what's happening is they advertise for those jobs. The American workers either don't show up and to claim the jobs, or they work for a day or two and then they're gone. The guest workers, the Hispanics, mainly, they're coming into the peach areas, and I talked with a peach farmer yesterday about this. They're the only workers they can find that will actually do the job and stay on the job for the whole picking season are the Hispanics that they bring in as guest workers, and they're having to pay those a higher minimum wage. So what happened? The farmer's margins just shrunk because he's having to pay a higher wage. It needs to be uniform. The plan isn't working to encourage American employers to hire Americans because Americans aren't taking the jobs, and what it's done is just shrunk the margins and made the businesses less profitable.
Sure. Well, you know, if you were paying American workers $9.79 plus housing plus free transportation, you might get a different outcome too, Jeff.
Well, I agree with that. And there's no requirement that we have to. Well, there's a requirement that they have to provide some sort of housing and whatnot for the guest workers. So there are some requirements on the federal government under the current existing guest worker program. So, you know, it's not apple to apple comparison.
No.
And so I think we need to have that conversation. But I think as part of that, Ann, we need to have a conversation about the welfare reform as well, because, you know, what we're paying in welfare benefits to folks that are just not looking for work or on some sort of government program, subsistence program, are we incentivizing them to continue to perpetually be on the government's dole, or do we some sort of phase out of those plans to try to encourage them to get back to work?
Sure. Well, you know, the farm bill that the Senate just passed was nearly $1 trillion. And now I understand y'all are taking up your own version of the farm bill in Congress. When you were on back in March, we talked about that it was 20% agricultural, 80% welfare on the bill.
That's correct. We're going to vote on that this week. And
but
80%
has the bill,
of what's known as the farm bill is really a nutrition or welfare subsistence bill. Only 20% deals with agricultural programs.
But when we talked back in March, you said you were looking forward to the fact that they were going to revamp the bill. And where do you stand? I mean, have you read this 1,200-page bill?
We have not read it all. I personally have not read it all. I've been following the farm bill since I got here because I come from the Agricultural Committee in Columbia in the State House. I talk with a lot of farmers and ag folks, but I also talk with a lot of people that are frustrated about what they see back home is a level of subsistence that's perpetual, and the frustration because they have to go to work every day, and what they see folks that aren't going to work that are, you know, living a certain lifestyle. So I've been following this issue, trying to understand, you know, the percentages of truly ag programs, the crop insurance and that sort of thing, and what is generally dubbed as the nutrition side of it, although it's well beyond nutrition. It's more of a welfare bill. So I think we need some sort of reform to that mandatory spending side. It's approaching $1 trillion in the House version. That's a little between $900 billion and $1 trillion. You know, our side is saying that it's $33 billion in reduction of mandatory spending. Well, it is if you look at the CBO baseline number, which is a plussed up or an increased post-stimulus bill number, where the Obama administration, Democrat Congress, during the stimulus bill, jacked up the spending and the welfare programs within the farm bill. And so the $33 billion is off that increased number, that post-stimulus number. And I've said, look, if we're going to have a real conversation, let's go back to the pre-stimulus number and work off that number, which is, I think, where we should be. That's not the case, though.
Well, you know, I was reading in the Senate bill an article that said the money for the rich is the rule, not the exception. The USDA's Economic Research Service reports that two-thirds of the farms with incomes exceeding $1 million annually receive government payments averaging almost $55,000, and just 20% 27% of the farms with income less than 100,000 received payments of 4,400, and that was back from 2011. So we have big farmers doing very, very well with this bill, and the smaller farmers not doing very well. If we're giving a farm bill to aid farms, that doesn't seem to be very equitable, does it?
Well, I think we ought to have that conversation, and I would welcome that in a true debate about ag programs. I think we ought to divide this bill up and divide the question into the 80-20 sections, and let's have a conversation about what we do or do not do for America's farmers, and let's have a conversation about welfare reform and separate those two. It's hard to have a really above-the-board conversation about those issues you're talking about on which farmers get to what, but the big farms I know that are receiving more of the money you're talking about are the large farms that are taking a lot larger risk. They're planting more crops, more acres, and milking larger herds and other things. But I will say this: I got a copy of the Democratic floor strategy on the farm bill, and one of the things they say on here to show you the difference: Democrats say every amendment that eliminates or reduces payments to farmers helps Democrats preserve and protect SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Program,
sure,
conservation and other progressive priorities in conference negotiations. So, you know, they're approaching this as trying to preserve that huge welfare spending side of the bill, and they said every amendment that eliminates or reduces payments to farmers helps the Democrats preserve those other programs. So I don't believe we can have this debate in this this setting where those two things are married together with the welfare or the nutrition side and the ag side. I really believe we need to divide the question so we can have a conversation about the farming and the ag community and what we do as Americans for conservation, land stewardship, and ag programs. And I think we have a conversation about welfare. Now, I will say one thing about the farm bill, whether it's this bill or a divided bill, which what I would love to see, is that it comes down to national security issue as well, is that I want to make sure that American farmers can feed Americans and that we can rely on our food to be grown here in America, because the way it continues and farms going out of business, dairy farms going out of business, we're going to be more reliant on other parts of the globe to provide our basic subsistence, and that puts America in a bad position.
Absolutely, it does. You know, that goes to my next thing that I wanted to bring up, Jeff. I think you should introduce a law or a bill that says that no bill coming before either the House or the Senate, I guess it would just be for the House, can be longer than 10 pages. How can you even disseminate all the information in a 1,200-page bill?
Well, I agree. You know, if you got this bill, it's 1,200 pages. You had Obamacare, it was 2,800 pages. You've had other bills. The immigration bill, I think, is almost as big as Obamacare. It weighs about 48 pounds or something. It's some god-awful number. I agree. Now, I don't think we can actually get things done in 10 pages.
Okay.
But I would be willing to use a common-sense number of 50 or 100 pages, because it depends on the subject. And sometimes...
Well, then do another bill. If the subject's too big, do another bill.
But it depends on the subject. I don't disagree with you at all. I think it ought to be simple. I think our American framers envisioned that the common person with a common education will be able to take a piece of legislation, read it within a reasonable amount of time, and fully understand what that was going to do, not only to them, but to their fellow citizens' lives and what it meant ultimately to the nation. I think we need to get back to those core principles, right, in common English. If we reference another code section, describe plainly what that code section is, what the effect is on that that other section of the law, because what we saw in Obamacare, using that as an example, is they changed laws all over the spectrum by pulling different code sections and eliminating or adding to. And you would have to spread that bill out on the gymnasium floor with a lot of strings attached, going to all the different sections of the law to try to figure out, you know, what was affected. And then there was a carte blanche rule writing ability for DHHS, for Kathleen Sebelius's agency to do rulemaking under that law, which gives them unprecedented, I believe, legislative type power within an agency, which I think is wrong. So I go back to what you said, a 10 page or less bill is fine, as long as it's the gist of it is common sense. a common sense length bill that's written in American English, that's written in language that the average person can understand, and they can understand the effect it's going to have on them and their lives and their family and their property and their neighbors and their communities.
Absolutely. Well, we just had a call from George McKesson. He said, with the farm bill having little to do with farming, why not call it the stealth welfare bill?
Well, we're hearing it called the farm and welfare bill by some folks. I think Heritage just put something out that, you know, doesn't just call it the farm bill. They play games with names up here all the time, but I will say we understand that this bill deals with 80% welfare, nutrition programs, and other things, and for more progressive type of programs, and we see about 20% of the bill being a true agricultural bill. And if I had my druthers, we'd divide that 80-20 and we'd have two separate bills that we could debate and really have a good conversation about what we want to do for America.
So where do you think you're going to stand on the farm bill since that's supposed to come up for a vote this week?
Well, after 230-something amendments were offered, and I don't know how they're going to affect the overall version of the farm bill, because some amendments may pass and some may not. Some are good amendments, some are trash amendments that I don't like. So I'm a reserve where I'm going to vote on this, but right now I'm leaning no because of the increase of stimulus spending in the welfare side of it that jacked the number up by about $267 billion over the pre-stimulus number. And, you know, I want to work off a lower number. I came here, I'm a conservative, I'm unabashed about that. I believe we've got to really watch our spending, and this is one driver of our deficit and requiring us to borrow money. And, you know, I'm tired of indebting my children and future generations.
Absolutely. Well, Congressman Jeff Duncan, you've certainly been out there. You were on my show a few weeks ago. We were talking about shutting down the IRS and going with a single, you know, fair tax where you just pay it. At the end of the day, you can say, I've paid my taxes. Then you came out with the IRS training with assault rifles in Maryland. And what was it, last week you were talking with Rick Wiles about birtherism. What's going on? Do you think we ought to go back to investigate President Obama's birth certificate?
Well, let's back up. I talked with a gentleman in Florida on the radio about the IRS and a number of other scandals, and that's one thing we're focused on up here, Ann, is, you know, let's talk about this Chicago-style thuggery coming out of the White House and administration, where they take your tax dollars and pay their cronies, a la Solyndra and others, or they use Chicago thuggery-style tactics where they use a government agency like the IRS to intimidate conservative groups, as we see with the IRS targeting conservative Tea Party folks, or the NSA spying on Americans and taking their data of text and emails and phone calls, and what they're doing with that or what they're not doing with that, try to keep America safe is a question. We see Benghazi that had the lives of four Americans that were lost, and we still haven't gotten the answers to what Chris Stevens was doing in Benghazi and what exactly was going on with a possible gun running scheme to get guns in the hands of the Syrian rebels even before present day. Those questions need to be asked. We've got so many scandals with the AP and the Fox News reporter where their emails and phones were tapped by the Justice Department, and whether that was a valid warrant or not, and that's got folks outraged. So we're keeping our eye on the ball. Now, I did talk to the gentleman about that, and folks have taken some responses there at the end of the comment, or end of the 20-minute interview, and tried to interpret them to meet their needs about whether I believe the president's illegal or not. And I'm not going there today because I know what I said, I know what I believe. But
sure.
Yeah, at the end of the day, we're focusing on all the things that are going on up here to try to thwart this big government approach, this the fact that it's eroding our personal liberties, and people are frustrated with what they see happening in Washington out of their own government. There is distrust for the government, and they don't want to distrust their government. As I said last week in a hearing that I had, you know, I don't believe that Americans want to distrust their government. I don't think Americans want to believe that their government is buying up all the ammo and keeping them from being able to buy it on their supporting its shelves. I don't believe that American citizens want to believe that the government is buying mine-resistant armor first mail carriers to the tune of 2,700 to the DHS. Now, that number is wrong, but I don't believe Americans want to believe that. But they do believe that, and that leads to distrust. I don't think Americans want to believe the IRS is targeting certain groups. I don't think the Americans want to believe NSA is snooping on their phone calls and their email searches and other things. I just don't believe Americans want to distrust their government, but they currently do. And we, since they do, we've got to do make sure that the federal agencies do a better job communicating. We need to get the truth out there, compare apples to apples, and we need to stop these, I go back to the Chicago-style political thuggery that we see coming out of this administration, using government agencies as their lynchmen and spying on Americans.
You know, Jeff, did you know that the government was storing all these records? Because it's been, I've heard a lot of stuff in the news, and some Congress senators said, oh, yeah, we knew, oh, no, we didn't know. Where were you on this as far as knowing that the government was compiling all this and storing all the variety of records that we now know they're storing?
Well, the president tried to punt the ball back to Congress and say we were briefed on that. When we weren't, there may have been elements within the intel community and intel committee that were briefed about it, no little more than the average congressman knew. No, we weren't briefed on all that. Now, having researched, I realized that most phone calls and wherever they originate overseas around the world, and most Internet transactions, whether it's email or searches, route through the United States at some point in time, whether it's through a server or some sort of a link. And the NSA recognized we're in a different world. We're not just listening to the microwave transmissions or the electronic transmissions come out of the Iron Curtain or behind the Iron Curtain like we saw during the Cold War. So their missions changed to try to keep America safe. Knowing that all those phone calls and text messages and emails and other things do come through the United States at some point in time, they tried to capitalize on that advantage of being able to monitor some of that. Now, when they capture your emails or my emails as American citizens and what they do with that and whether they hold on to that or how long they hold on to it, what they do with that information, or whether it's stored indefinitely, that's where the line may be crossed. That's where we need to have some concern, because the Fourth Amendment says we should be secure in our persons and our papers. That's our private communications, whether it's letters, emails, phone calls. The Fourth Amendment requires them to get a warrant to justify the need to look at our personal papers to see if we committed a crime. They've got to have just cause for that. So did they cross the line of the Fourth Amendment in holding on to all that data or utilizing that data in some other way? That's the question that's being asked. But I think the NSA does a great job to keep America safe and have since its inception. But did this administration or other administrations urge NSA to do things they shouldn't have done? I think those are the questions we've got to ask, and we are asking.
You are asking. Real quick, any update on Benghazi? Anything more you can tell us about Benghazi? Because it just seems with the IRS scandal going on, we've kind of that's kind of slid to the back.
Well, just it's either today or tomorrow. The commanding officer, General Hamm, will be testifying before the Armed Services Committee about Benghazi. Now, this was a gentleman that can either tell us there was a special rapid deployment force or special forces group in Europe that could have been deployed within the matter of hours to try to save those four Americans, or whether other assets in the area. He can answer some questions. Was there a stand-down order given to him from his commander-in-chief or higher-ups? He can answer that question. He was either relieved of command or his command was shifted shortly after Benghazi. You know, that makes me and the other Americans raise our eyebrows. Why was the guy that was commanding in that theater removed from his job or forced to retire or relocated shortly thereafter? I can't remember which it was, but he was definitely taken out of that role. Why? Did he know something? So he'll answer those questions this week. And that's part of this ongoing Benghazi investigation. You now see the Armed Services Committee having a hearing where Foreign Affairs has had a hearing with Secretary Clinton. Oversight and Governmental Reform Committee has had numerous hearings on Benghazi. You see Judiciary get involved just a little bit. So it's numerous committees of numerous jurisdictions all still swimming through this this pile of information and trying to answer questions and get answers to questions that Americans have. So it's ongoing.
Ongoing. Okay. And can I ask you one more question? You voted against the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, this year, but in the past you had voted for it. What changed your mind?
Well, I voted for the conference report last year, and I voted against the House version, I believe, but our goal was, last Congress, was try to shore up and get clearer the indefinite detention of American citizens language in there. And we worked with Lindsey Graham's office when the bill was over on the Senate side and then in the conference to try to make sure that language met some of the requirements that we had. I worked with Louis Gohmert from Texas and Justin Amash from Michigan on some of that, Jeff Landry, who's no longer in Congress, from Louisiana. And we felt a little bit more certain in the conference report last year. It was something that I felt like we were making progress on, and I support it. But at the end of the day, this year, in the new NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, I still have questions about personal liberties and the indefinite detention of American citizens on U.S. soil. I've got questions about drone use, whether it's overseas or here, and over this country. So I just didn't feel comfortable with that. Plus, the level of spending was increased. And it all goes back to trying to be fiscally responsible in these days of austerity and days of debt and deficits. And so at the end of the day, I couldn't support it. But it passed the House. It'll go to the Senate. It'll be a different version, and it'll go to conference, and we'll see what the final conference report looks like.
Absolutely. Well, Congressman Jeff Duncan, you know, with all the scandals up there, your head has to be swimming every day trying to figure out the direction. I know being fiscally conservative and this, but still, it has to be tough with so much information coming out every day.
Yeah, it's really the number of topics we've just covered in the last 15 minutes or 20 minutes we've been on the phone. It just gives you some indication of what we deal with on a day-to-day basis. But you know, we could throw the Syrian involvement in the mix. We could throw what the U.S. does for the state of Israel in the mix. We could throw the Iranian threat and Hezbollah and our southern border and the Western Hemisphere into the mix. We could throw energy security and my goal of trying to be more energy independent here in this country and utilizing our resources to meet our energy needs. We could throw that in the mix. And there's just a number of other things that are going on that we could talk on and on about. But I enjoy the job. I enjoy doing all that we do and working with this delegation that I'm very proud to serve with, who have strengths in various areas, and we all sort of lean on each other. So the topics are fascinating, and I think we are making a difference of pushing our country to a more conservative fiscal position and continuing to work with American citizens to try to answer the questions that we have about what's going on with all these scandals. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm humbled to do it, and I want to walk over the Capitol. I'll walk outside before I go vote because I want to look up at that dome. I want to know where I'm going. I want to realize that, you know, I've given this tremendous honor to serve here and what it means to serve in the nation's capital and serve the people of the 3rd District. So, you know, I appreciate the opportunity to get on your show and share some of my thoughts with the folks that listen in.
Absolutely, and we appreciate you taking the time and giving us clarification on stuff instead of just sound bites that seem to jump out there sometimes.
Well, I look forward to getting back on. I love your show. I love Ann, and look forward to getting back on again.
All right. Thank you so much, Congressman Jeff Duncan. God bless. Keep up the fight.
God bless you, Ann. God bless America. Take care.
All righty. Bye-bye.